From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The state's highest court hears a case challenging the constitutionality of federal immigration detention requests.
But there have been ICE and before that INS detainers for many years. Why has this issue never surfaced before in this or any other court, to my knowledge?
Also today, a new biography explores the life, legacy, and lessons from Richard Nixon's presidency.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
And Turing Award recipient and inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, on why he's still optimistic about tech, even in the era of fake news and government surveillance.
I am optimistic, but it's only going to happen because lots of people care about it very, very much. And that's not just people writing code.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Can local law enforcement agencies detain someone at the request of federal immigration authorities, or is that in violation of the Massachusetts state constitution? That was the question before the state's highest court today in the case of Commonwealth v. Lun, a Cambodian national who was detained by state court officers at the request of federal immigration officials, even though Lun's state criminal case had been dismissed. WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling has been following this case and today's oral argument before the Supreme Judicial Court, and she joins us now. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
So walk us through some of more of the details. What is the SJC being asked to consider here?
Right. So at its core, this case is about how much authority local police and local courts have when it comes to honoring what are called ICE detainers. And so an ICE detainer is a voluntary request from the federal government to hold a person in custody whose criminal case has been settled, so meaning that charges have been dismissed or they've posted bail or their jail sentence has been completed. And so a detainer gives ICE up to 2 days to look into that person's immigration status and potentially pursue deportation while that person remains in custody. And this is what's at question. Are local law enforcement and courts constitutionally allowed to do that, to hold someone who otherwise is free to go based solely on this request from ICE?
And since this is the SJC, we're talking about the Massachusetts state constitution here, right?
Exactly.
So what's at stake? I mean, I know you've spoken with local police departments about this case. What are they saying?
That's right. I mean, essentially right now, local law enforcement is in the position of sort of deciding on a one-off basis which ICE detainers they're going to honor, right? Because these are voluntary requests from ICE. They don't come with an arrest warrant, which would legally bind local departments to hold someone. They're requests. And the chief of police in Chelsea, Brian Kies, for one, says he's following the case closely.
We're just trying to understand from our perspective as police chiefs, police officers, what can we quote-unquote honor and what can we not honor?
So those are ICE detainers that he's talking about honoring. Which ICE detainers can we honor and which ones should we not be honoring? It's up to us at this point. So Chief Kies says it's really a complicated process and he's hoping to get some real clarification, some real guidance from the SJC.
So the case is called Commonwealth v. Lun, meaning that people arguing on either side would be the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and Mr. Lun, I mean, what were the basic arguments we heard?
Right. So it was interesting because for the defendant in the case, the question is actually moot because he was, in fact, already taken into federal custody. But the SJC agreed to hear the case because it's a recurring issue and it's relevant. So Emma Winger is a lawyer for the defendant, and she says this isn't about who ICE can and cannot deport. Okay, so this is it, that's not what's at question here. Instead, she's asking the court to weigh in on whether local law enforcement and courts, when they hold someone for civil immigration matters at the request of those ICE detainers, is that constitutional? And what she's arguing is that according to the state's constitution and even the federal constitution, actually, she's arguing that that is unconstitutional. Local enforcement does not have the authority to do that. And Winger says with Trump's administration, new immigration priorities, now is the time to consider this question around ICE detainers.
We know that ICE is now going to be issuing many more detainers, and detainers not just for people with criminal convictions or criminal records, but anybody that they think is deportable. And so our law enforcement and our courts are entitled to some guidance about whether or not the act of honoring detainer is legal.
Hmm. So the Attorney General's office also argued or presented oral argument in today's case before the SJC. What was their take on this?
Right. So you mentioned it was Commonwealth v. Lunn. Yeah. And so the Commonwealth and the Suffolk County Sheriff are both parties to this case. And Jessica Barnett represented the AG's office. The AG was representing the Commonwealth. And Jessica Barnett was there for the AG's office. And I mean, at one point, Justice Hines asked Barnett to clarify exactly how the AG's brief differed from that of the defendant. So very similar stances here. So explain exactly what's going on here. What's the Commonwealth arguing? And the answer essentially is the scope of what the court is being asked to consider. And so the AG's office says, listen, the state agrees with the basic premise of the defense, which is that the state law does not authorize local law enforcement, police officers, sheriffs, and courts to arrest people for civil immigration violations. That's not allowed under our Constitution. But the AG's office also maintains that these are voluntary. And so police have an opportunity to not honor these. And the fact that these are voluntary requests is sort of that like protection, that fail-safe against immigrants, you know, potentially having their constitutional liberties violated because, you know, Chief Kies, who we heard from, said, I can decide which ones I do and don't honor. And the AG's office is saying that's a good enough fail-safe for now. Let's not wade into the constitutionality of this. Whereas Emma Winger, on the behalf of Lunn, is saying, no, this is unconstitutional. We need you to take a stand on this, SJC, and deem it unconstitutional so that we can have guidance moving forward.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's WBU reporter Shannon Dooling bringing us up to speed on a very interesting case heard today before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Shannon, thank you as always.
Thank you.
All right. Let's turn now for further legal analysis from Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a former Massachusetts federal judge. She's now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. And thank goodness she's our WBR legal analyst, because Judge Gertner, there's a lot to wade in through here. I mean, this seems like a very significant case before the SJC. What's the main legal debate here?
Well, first, it is extraordinary that the SJC took this. One of the reasons why this issue doesn't ever get litigated is because it always becomes moot, right? The person is then in DHS custody, is in Homeland Security custody, and is deported. So, and all of this takes place without counsel, without an opportunity, the detainer rather, without an opportunity to challenge it. So what the first thing that the SJC did is to say, this is an issue we're going to consider because it's capable of being repeated, of recurring, and that's why we're going to take it. That was the first significant issue. And so to some degree, we're in uncharted territory because these issues rarely come up. The constitutional issue is bifurcated, so on federal and state. The state says that there is no such thing as authority to do for a state arrest for a civil deportation violation. And while the government says it's only 48 hours, there's no such thing as only a 48-hour detention. The fact of detention triggers constitutional safeguards. So the state constitution is implicated, whether the source of it is voluntary or not. To the person being detained, it doesn't matter. My sense was that the Commonwealth was also arguing that you don't have to get to the constitutional issue because there is no such thing in Massachusetts as the authority to arrest for a civil violation. So don't get to intergalactic constitutional issues when there's no authority and that ends the matter. Just announce there's no authority here.
Right. And because this was the part of the oral argument made by Assistant AG Burnett, which I think I understood correctly, where she was pointing to the fact that in certain cases where there is civil detention, it's because the legislature has made specific laws around them. For example, substance abuse.
Right.
And so they've gone to the great lengths to say, under these very specific cases, there can be civil detention, but there are none for immigration.
Well, that's right, and specific safeguards. You need to dial back what an ICE detainer is. An ICE detainer is an administrative official saying, I think there's probable cause that this person is deportable. I have looked up on our website, or I've looked up on our computer, rather. They talk about biometric measures, and this person seems to fit the profile of someone who's deportable. This person is in the various specific categories of deportation. This is an administrative official. No process, no hearing preceded that. It's a piece of paper in which it is an administrative official's conclusions of deportability. There's no paper attached to it.
It's not an independently issued warrant.
And it's not independently issued by a judicial officer or even an administrative law judge, nor is there any paper attached to it that says, here are the grounds for my belief.
Right.
So it is at bottom a notice provision, but it is being used as a detention provision.
So let me just play a little bit of tape here, because the justice has asked a lot of really interesting questions today, including they wanted the attorneys, both from the Commonwealth and Lund's attorney, to argue what exactly constitutes an arrest. I mean, you were talking about what does detention mean in this case. So we have some tape where Justice David Lowy asked this very question. He was wondering, is it adequate for immigration officials to issue that agency detention request if they're concerned about a person's flight risk? And here's how attorney Emma Winger answered.
There does need to be judicial oversight of any arrest, even where there's a flight risk.
Would that be an arrest? I guess that's what I'm asking. That's what we're trying to get around
sure.
to, really. So the ICE has a finding that this person might be a risk of escape under 1357, and the person is released from state custody, and ICE says, well, we can be there in 20 minutes. If the sheriff or court officer holds that person for 20 minutes, is that an arrest?
It is, Your Honor. It's not it's not for investigatory purposes. It's holding somebody after they would otherwise be released, where there's no basis under Massachusetts law to do so.
Judge Gertner, what do you make of that? Because, of course, as you know, the federal government would argue that it does not constitute an arrest.
Well, it's very interesting. In a criminal setting, right, I can't detain you for the purposes of questioning you, even when I have, when I don't have any grounds for believing that you committed a crime. We have a very elaborate law with respect to when you can stop someone to question them, when you can arrest someone. So this is holding someone in a cell where the basis for it could be that there's a flight risk, but there is no one who has determined that it's a flight risk. In other words, what's interesting about the justice's question is that the piece of paper that authorizes this detention doesn't have as a category, is this person likely to flee? In other words, I think the way to dial it back is to say, clearly it's a detention. You're being held in custody. The person doing the detaining or the process that started it is someone who is not a judicial officer. There is no one who has reviewed this to see if it's appropriate. And one thing that's interesting about the briefs here was that even immigration officers, ICE officers, have the authority to arrest that in which they have to determine that someone is a flight risk. This is not even as formal as an ICE officer's authority to arrest on a legitimate immigration of order of removal. Yeah. This is something considerably less formal. And what's so interesting about this, and I was a federal judge, we respected ICE detainers. Oftentimes, someone would be released in my court to an ICE detainer. I don't think I ever appreciated the informality of the process.
Uh-huh. Well, you mentioned the briefs that were filed in this case. My favorite one actually comes from the United States. That's what it said, filed by the United States. It was filed by members of the Trump administration. And in fact, Joshua Press from the Department of Justice did appear before the Supreme Judicial Court today to offer some oral argument. And he interestingly opened his time before the justices talking about Mr. Lund's criminal history. In fact, he went out of his way to say that no one before the SJC today seems to, quote, want to talk about Lund himself, that he had lost his legal permanent resident status, he had been ordered deported, had been rearrested, etc. He emphasized that. He got some pushback from the justices saying that, honestly, the question before them made his previous history beside the point, and that the point was the detention requests after the completion of criminal proceedings for Mr. Lunn. And to that pushback, here's how Joshua Press from the DOJ responded.
I want to be very crystal clear here. There are no federal demands being made through this procedure. This is a request, as a matter of comedy, from one law enforcement agency to another to hold, well, number one, to provide notice of the release of that alien, and, or number two, to hold him up to 48 hours to effectuate the detention and eventual removal of that alien from the United States. Now, there are, and there will be, of course, from state to state, different restrictions placed on state officers. I understand in this, in the Commonwealth, for example, 48 hours is too long. 24 hours is the rule, and we have no quarrel with that. That's why, in this case, Mr. Lunn was picked up within hours of the Commonwealth declining to prosecute.
That was so interesting to me, Judge Gertner. I mean, is Joshua Press essentially saying, there's no case here? What are we even doing here?
Well, he wants to tell the court, because this is moot as to this particular individual, don't bother to address it. But the court is very interesting.
He also said they're honoring Massachusetts law.
Well, they're honoring Massachusetts law with respect to the time of holding, but not with respect to the authority to arrest. I want to go back to the detainer. It says that someone can be detained where the alien's voluntary statements or other reliable evidence indicate that he lacks immigration status, right? So an official of the government, not a police officer, not a magistrate, can say, gee, based on other reliable information, I think you're deportable. And the basis of, and on that basis, the person is detained. This is not little, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or 48 hours. This is not little. This is in a holding facility without counsel and without the opportunity to address this.
There's one more moment from today's oral argument that I want to play, because I think the justices got to a question that maybe a lot of people are wondering. They basically asked Assistant Attorney General Jessica Barnett, why now? Why are we hearing this case now?
There have been ICE and before that INS detainers for many years. Why is this issue never surfaced before in this or any other court, to my knowledge?
I think it's been coming up now that you have this specific request within the detainer to hold beyond the period where the person's held in state custody.
That's been going on. I was a trial judge for 19 years, and people, and we all know this. You know, everyone in this courtroom, I think, knows this. Court officers have been holding individuals with ICE detainers, and sheriffs have for a long time. Sometimes it's 15 minutes because there's a lot of traffic. Sometimes it's 20 minutes. Sometimes it's 40 minutes. It's not till the end of the day.
Well,
so going back to the chief's question, I think it's a good question. I mean, this has been going on sub rosa for a long, long time.
And I think that goes to the issue of the brief detentions are more likely to go unnoticed because this has evolved to where the federal government is requesting 48 hours of detention, sometimes excluding Saturdays and holidays. You have, for example, in the Morales versus Chadbourne case, a United States citizen who's being detained and held for a number of days. That's going to come to light.
Judge Gertner?
I think part of it is that it was difficult to identify. I mean, that's, I'm answering the question that you didn't ask. I mean, part of it is it was difficult to identify precisely because the person is then in deportation proceedings and doesn't address this. It has come out when you're in state custody on an imprisonment sentence and then held for on a detainer to go into federal custody. I mean, I think that the answer is, one, that it's been difficult to challenge, and two, given President Trump's goal here, it is going to happen much more with and the possibilities of more lengthy detentions are clear because this will depend upon officers rushing to capture these people. It is also important to say that the reason why the United States government is dancing around the issue in the way they are is that the U.S. government cannot command state authorities to arrest someone. They cannot command, and that's a violation of federalism, of the 10th Amendment. So this has to be a voluntary civil arrest. And in the absence of either statutory authorization or constitutional requirements, what the Commonwealth is saying and what the plaintiff is saying is you can't do it.
Well, in the United States amicus brief that it filed, it says detaining such aliens for no more than 48 hours so that immigration authorities can assume custody to effectuate their removal does not violate the United States Constitution. My last question for you, Judge Gertner, is what implications could this case have beyond Massachusetts, if any?
Well, it could provide, you know, this is a very fine court, as I've said on this program many times, and a decision from this court could provide a template to other state courts around the country. And then you'll have an interesting situation. If state authorities refuse to implement federal detainers, federal authorities are going to have to change the way they enforce immigration rules.
Nancy Gertner is a former federal judge. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thank you so much. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A president who attacks elites, hates the media, puts out charges of election fraud, and faces allegations of having colluded with a foreign government. We are not describing President Donald Trump. We are describing President Richard Nixon, who did call the press, quote, lousy, dirty, cowardly bastards, claimed a connection with the forgotten man of America, and opened up a back channel to the president of South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. Nixon also claimed to be the law and order candidate in 1968 when he accepted the Republican nomination for the presidency.
To those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice, justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect.
Well, that is a theme that President Donald Trump explicitly echoed. Here he is in July at the Republican National Convention.
In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
Well, the lessons and legacy that we can draw from Richard Nixon is the subject of a new fantastic biography of the late president. It's called Richard Nixon, The Life. It's by John A. Farrell, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, it's great to be back.
A lot of biographies have been written about President Nixon. Why did you decide to take on this life now?
There was a new audience, and there was a fire hydrant worth of new material. It's kind of hard for we baby boomers to deal with, but 2/3 of the American population were either not born or not living in the United States when Richard Nixon left office. And the millennials now are the single biggest generation, and they know Nixon only as a caricature on The Simpsons or the bad guy in the X-Men's movie. So I really wanted to reach out to them and give them one volume that incorporates all the new material that's come out in the last 20 years that they can go to if they have a little bit more interest in the real guy.
Okay, so I want to get to some of the amazing new details that you uncover in the book. But before we do, I mean, we more than intimated that people are talking about Nixon now also vis-a-vis President Donald Trump. I mean, is that a fair comparison to make to our current president?
Somebody said the other day that we've had marches in the streets, allegations of eavesdropping, break-ins at the DNC. It's like we have the Nixon administration on speed dial because it took Nixon 2.5 years to go from Watergate to resignation, and we've had all this in only 6 weeks with Donald Trump. Personally, aside from a certain grandiosity, which is evident on Nixon's tapes and Trump's tweets, they're very different men. But the number of coincidences in their administrations is amazing. And I think also they both have a political way of trying to tap on people's grievances, on the dark side of people, on their fears, racial fears or economic fears or fears about class. And I think that pretty much sums up their similarities and differences.
But different men? I mean, very different men? How? Tell me more about how they're different.
Very different men. Nixon came from the California outback. The pictures of where he grew up looked like Oklahoma in the middle of the Dust Bowl. And he had an awful, abusive father, and he had a mother who famously would retreat to her closet to pray and, as Nixon once said, never told me that she loved me in my life. So he always had this chip on his shoulder, and then all of a sudden in his childhood, his younger brother dies in a week, and then his older brother gets tuberculosis and dies over 6 years, wasting the family's fortune. Nixon can't go to Ivy League schools. He has to go to Little Whittier College, and he always carries this feeling that the world is cheating him, that that his enemies are out there out to get him. Donald Trump, born of a wealthy man, set off to military school at the age of 12, which is not exactly a great childhood, I don't imagine. But I don't see a great deal of comparisons between the two men in their upbringing.
Interesting. Okay. I might want to circle back to that in a minute. But let's get right to one of the things.
I'm all for pop psychology.
But I want to get to one of the things which that you uncover in the book, which is just... I mean, it's stunning that nobody really knew, I guess, about Nixon before you published it. And in order to introduce it, I first want to just play a little tape. This is from 1969. This is November 1969 when President Richard Nixon is giving a speech on the Vietnam War, and he advocated for troop reductions but a continuation of fighting. So here's President Nixon.
Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
That silent majority speech. But the thing you uncovered is what Nixon did the year before in 1968.
It's a remarkable piece of the puzzle I was able to chance upon in my research. It had always been rumored that Nixon had approached the Nixon campaign had approached the South Vietnamese in October 68 and tried to scuttle Lyndon Johnson's peace initiative by telling them that if they just held on a little bit longer, they would get a better deal when Nixon took office. And indeed, what I found was notes that of conversation between Nixon barking orders to his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman, telling them that we've got to get work on the South Vietnamese, tell them to drag their feet. We're going to monkey wrench these talks. So, as I said, it had long been rumored that this happened. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson had been tapping the phones of the South Vietnamese embassy and had proof that it was happened. But we never could put the words actually in Nixon's mouth. And that was able to do in the book.
This is stunning.
Well, it's for a biographer, it's amazing because it really shows the moral character of the man, that he was willing to put so many lives at stake for this expedient political reason. And you can't say what would have happened if he hadn't done this, that there would have been peace. You can't make that decision. But we do know that there were so many lives at stake. 2 million Cambodians, 1 million South Vietnamese boat people, and 20,000 more Americans died in Nixon's first term.
I mean— Does that not qualify as treason? Am I going too far in saying that? Like he said he's going to scuttle peace talks.
In this conversation that we're having right now about Russiagate and Trump, you will hear something called the Logan Act popped up from time to time. And the Logan Act is this very obscure a law that was passed by the Founding Fathers, actually. And it says that Americans are not supposed to interfere in the diplomacy of the country with their own private diplomacy. And obviously that's what Nixon did, and it's possible that somebody on the Trump team did that as well, interceding with the Russians last fall.
I mean, H.R. Haldeman, who you mentioned, has said don't ever lose sight of Vietnam as the overriding factor in Nixon's first term.
Yeah, one of the things that I was able to use that other biographers have not been able to use is all the tapes have been coming out. And there's one particularly ugly, chilling tape where John Connolly, who was his Treasury Secretary, and Haldeman are talking about the bombing of North Vietnam. And John Connolly says, you know, we really haven't put terror in the hearts of the civilians yet. You've been worrying too much about slop over. And Haldeman says, yeah, what difference is it? What, you know, why the bodies are there or how many people you kill? And Nixon says, no slop over. And they say, yeah, right, no slop over. And slop over was the euphemism for dead civilians.
Well, I mean, we could spend our whole time just talking about Vietnam and Nixon. But there are so many other fascinating aspects about his presidency and about his approach to power, right? Nixon famously hated the press, right? He may not have ever, I mean, he didn't have Twitter, but but he, I don't think he actually ever, did he ever utter the his disdain for the press as President Trump has had?
Almost word for word. There's a famous quote from Nixon on the tapes where he says, "Henry, write this down. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy."
But he said this, that privately, though.
He said that privately. Yeah. The tapes and the tweets to me are like, they're both glimpses into presidential ids. And so that's the comparison that I like to make. But it's true. Nixon was, he would go to a press conference towards the end of his term and actually say, you know, don't think that you people out there have gotten me angry, because in order to be angry, you have to respect the person who's going to get you angry. So he was pretty icy with the press, but he never went as far as to try to convince the American people that the press is the enemy of the American people.
Interesting. But you also write that he had this canny understanding of how to circumvent the media, or the press, I should say, because, I mean, you write that when he was running as Eisenhower's vice president, that Nixon found that he could outflank the press and appeal to viewers directly through television.
There was a scandalous flap at the beginning of his run as vice president in 1952, and everybody knows it as the famous Checkers speech, because he used his little dog Checkers as this heart-tugging feature of the speech. He was accused of having a slush fund used for political purposes. The only way to get out of it was to go on national television, which was an unheard of thing at this time. And it probably is the single most effective use of television in American in politics. And now that the television has been somewhat degraded by the internet, it probably will always remain so. Basically, he resuscitated himself. He breathed new life into his own mouth.
You know, we are, I think, rightfully spending time on many of the highly controversial aspects of President Nixon's tenure in the White House. But, I mean, you also do write about some of his accomplishments, right? Like that he signed into law increases for Social Security, a 20% jump under Nixon, more money for education. He declared war on cancer, asked Congress to double arts funding. Also, maybe people don't realize this, but he had a significant environmental legacy as well. The National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act. He established, you know, other environmental major landmarks in the United States. So these aren't things that we usually associate with Nixon as a president.
No. The major environmental groups were polled several years back about who was the greatest green president, and they came in with Teddy Roosevelt first and Nixon second. He established the EPA, and it's sort of ironic to see this fellow who's president now, who says to be an admirer of president, dismantling the environmental protection. But the phrase that I use continually in the book is "and yet," because for almost everything despicable at Nixon, you can find something that's laudatory as well. And his administration invented affirmative action. And his administration was the biggest desegregator of Southern schools. And yet, he was also the creator of the Southern strategy that gave the South, through a thinly disguised racism, over to the Republican Party. So a very controversial character. It was a lot of fun making my way through those different alleyways of his mind.
Well, I want to play one more piece of tape, because regardless of President Nixon's accomplishments, I think there's pretty much one moment which in the popular mind of the United States defines him.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
That came after a particularly awkward moment, and Nixon actually established sort of the precedent of presidents showing their income tax returns, which Donald Trump has now dashed. But it was turned out that Nixon had taken a $400,000 tax break on his vice presidential papers that had been backdated by an aide, and he had to answer questions about that. You're right. But again, His final closing speech before he left the White House to get on the helicopter to go away, where he talks about never hate people, because once you hate them, then they've won and you destroy yourself, is just a wonderful, moving piece of Americana as well. So very complex guy. He doesn't fit easily into today's left and right. He sort of floats all by himself like an asteroid in space, and the Democrats will never forgive him, and the right has never adopted him since Reagan.
So let me ask you. I mean, of course, there's also Watergate, and that another famous phrase: "Cover up is worse than the crime."
Yep.
And I mean, you write about how people talk about Nixon collaborated in his own demise because of Watergate, but we've just got a minute here. I've got to ask you, how much does how Americans' attitudes about the presidency were transformed by Richard Nixon inform how we view all the tumult going on with the Trump presidency right now?
Absolutely. Nixon's downfall and the government investigations that followed, the Church Committee showed a tremendous amount of wrongdoing by Americans' presidents. And this great faith that they had put in the presidency during the Cold War sort of frittered away. I would say that we're returning to that right now. I don't know what the Trump people have done, but they're acting like they have something that they want to cover up, just like Nixon.
Well, the new biography is Richard Nixon, A Life. It's by John A. Farrell. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Glad to be here.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The winner of the Turing Prize was announced today. The award is considered the Nobel Prize in Computer Science. Google throws in a $1 million cash award, which is especially fitting because had it not been for this year's winner, Google itself would never have existed.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's a great honor.
That is Tim Berners-Lee, this year's Turing Prize winner. Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. Yes, you heard me correctly, Sir Tim. For not only is he currently an MIT professor, he has also been knighted by the Queen of England, too, for his achievements. Sir Tim invented the web, that digital space, that world through which so much information flows today, it feels as utterly essential as air. Did the visionary ever imagine back in 1989 that he'd create something that in 2017 millions and millions of people and companies say with a very straight face that they simply could not live without it?
Well, no, of course I didn't. I couldn't imagine that the project would be so successful. I mean, I had some projects which had been kind of successful that kind of worked and some that kind of didn't. So, no. It was designed, you know, I did call it the World Wide Web. It was designed to be universal. The whole point was breaking apart the silos of different documentation systems, if you like. And so the idea was that it could put anything on it. I never imagined that it would kind of have like everything on it.
Tim Berners-Lee is every bit the charming Englishman you're imagining right now. He's 61 and very much like a fountain of ideas, endlessly effervescing thoughts and questions, what ifs and how might we's. Now, you probably want to know the creation story of the web, and we'll give it to you in just a bit. But hang tight, because first, how about the creation story of Tim Berners-Lee? He was born in England in 1955 to a computationally inclined family.
Mom and Dad worked on the first computer to be commercialized in the UK. It was built by Manchester University, and it was commercialized by Franti, the company, and they worked Franti on that team. It was ridiculously exciting, clearly. All the people that they brought home to dinner were all very excited about the idea of a computer because as a programmable thing, the fact that when you, that really what it could do was limited by just the imagination of the program.
I heard you built a computer out of a television.
Yeah, obviously a computer was a goal. And so the first part that I tackled was the input-output, the screen and the keyboard. So I found an old calculator which was semi-mechanical, which had just rows and rows of switches. So I grabbed that out of an old dumpster, and it was sitting right at the bottom of a huge dumpster, quite an operation, and took it home. And then I went down to the TV shop and I asked the guy.
Let me just jump in here for a second to say that the inventor of the web still exudes enthusiasm and excitement for that first computer he ever built. With a couple of old TVs, it cost him less than 10 pounds. He spent several minutes of our interview walking us through all the details of its construction.
Now, I could have used the same technology of soldering together little integrated circuits to make a computer. I basically knew how to do it. But it would have been an awful lot of soldering. right, it would have been to build. You can build the technology name is called TTL, transistor logic, and you could build a computer out of TTL.
All the way until he finished building the thing in college.
So by the time I was out of Oxford, finished my physics degree, I had this running in the living room, which was really exciting.
Berners-Lee graduated from Oxford University and eventually ended up in Switzerland at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, home to the largest particle physics laboratory in the world. This is where the story of the World Wide Web really gets going, because in the 1980s, computers were everywhere at CERN. But they were all different models, running different programs, none of which talked to each other very well.
There's no rule at CERN. Everybody has to use the same sort of computer. So back then, 1989, that meant some people were starting to use these Macs and PCs. Some people were using mainframe computers, those huge things in the hall. Other people used mini computers. And so there was a massive diversity of different sort of computer. And then each one would come with its own way of keeping documents, storing documents, accessing documents. So if I wanted to find out about somebody's project, I'd have to go to their computer and learn some completely new documentation system.
Every single time.
Yeah. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, everything, of course. And this is why I love the birth story of the web, because ostensibly, Berners-Lee starts off with a very humble goal. Get the computers at CERN to share stuff a bit better, using the existing infrastructure of the internet to link information. So in 1989, Tim Berners-Lee matched his seemingly humble goal with a humbly titled paper called Information Management, a Proposal.
But actually, they're just all looking at pages and clicking on options. And so, in fact, they could all be thought of as hypertext. If you build a, if you think of a virtual hypertext system, you could actually imagine them all being part of this virtual hypertext system, and it wouldn't be that hard, in fact.
Tim Berners-Lee was about to change the world. But first, there was the matter of what to call his new information-sharing system. He eventually settled on the World Wide Web, but there were a few other contenders.
I like mine of information, the idea, but the problem with that is it was moi. Just sounded a little egocentric. I could have made it the information mine.
Or Tim.
But that would have been Tim. I talked about mesh was because it was, the idea was it was a sort of a tangled mesh of all kinds of things. Sounded a bit messy. So mesh and mess were a bit close to each other. So World Wide Web, I liked because, first of all, when you're writing code in those days, it was really useful to start with a letter that people didn't use. So people, one guy had written a whole system where it was called Zebra, where everything started with Z, so it didn't get confused with anything else. That was just a little practical thing. So I thought W, I could make it all W-based. So I called it WWW, and then there was having interviews about it, people would call and say, look, our spell check says that worldwide is one world. So it's actually W. Yours is, system is WW. It's not WWW. So I pushed back. Nope, it's WWW. World Wide Web are separate. that's just what it's called. There's a space between the world and the wide, so there. And that's how it's been.
But let's hop back to that humbly titled original paper, Information Management, a Proposal. Truth is, Tim Berners-Lee knew intuitively from the start that his relatively simple idea was about to change the world. And he describes it as a dream. Just a few years later, in a talk titled Hypertext and Our Collective Destiny, Tim Berners-Lee described, quote, a dream that the web could be an interactive sea of shared knowledge. He said, quote, I imagine it immersing us as a warm, friendly environment made of things we and our friends have seen, heard, believed, or have figured out. I would like it to bring our friends and colleagues closer. If misunderstandings are the cause of many of the world's woes, then can we not work them out in cyberspace? Berners-Lee said he wanted the web to become a realistic mirror, or in fact, the primary embodiment of the ways in which we work and play and socialize. And to that degree, it's been wildly successful beyond, you know, any measure, really.
Primary embodiment. Check!
Exactly.
Done that.
But the primary, but the embodiment of how we work, play, and socialize also includes sort of the darker parts of the human condition. In other words, Sir Tim's dream has also turned into something of a nightmare. The dark side of social media, of fake news, of government surveillance, the loss of control over private information, all the ways in which corporations are once again siloing the information that Berners-Lee had wished to set free with the original open web. That is why on this, the 28th year of the World Wide Web, its inventor is advocating a radical overhaul of his own creation.
So here's what I thought about this, and here's what I think about it. And they've changed last year. So what I thought about that, and what I spent 20 years, the first 20 years of the web, telling people what you need to do, keep the internet neutral. Just give everybody unfettered, non-discriminatory access to the internet. Let people build websites. Let them link to each other. Good stuff will happen. And so we fought for net neutrality. We got net neutrality. We have to fight. May have to fight for net neutrality again. I thought that all we had to do was to keep the net neutral. And then humanity, I have been quoted many times as saying I'm an optimist and I believe in humanity. And I believe that humanity will do the right thing. Now,
still, you're still an optimist.
I am still an optimist long term, but I think that we actually need to do a double take. We need to adjust our strategy. Those of us who feel the world can be a better place, can be more collaborative, that we can. Those original cyber utopian dreams that we will use technology to actually overcome national boundaries and overcome cultural boundaries and learn to love and get on with, collaborate with each other worldwide, they haven't actually happened. And so now, when you look at the web, for one thing, for many people, it's remarkably like the pre-web. Do you remember America Online?
Oh, yeah.
AOL
yeah.
Discs, when they used to dial into AOL, and AOL would be their entire world of internet information. It would be email, it would be news, it would be entertainment, it would be games. And it was a walled garden. It was a silo, but it was valuable, and people paid for it and got value, derived value out of it. But the web came along, the just sheer crazy innovation and creativity on the web blew away any walled garden, and it has consistently blown away any walled garden since. But now people do look around and they look at some of the social networks and they see the same sort of thing. And but also when they look at people using these social networks, they see that in particular social networks, particular things happen, and people who design those social networks are stepping back and they're realizing, whoa, you know, we put in anonymity for the people and for the protesters and for the people who are protesting against oppressive regimes, but now we find it's being used by misogynist bullies, by nasty people who just get at being nasty. So now people who design those networks have to rethink how they're designed to try to make them into places where actually nice things happen.
Because just last month you wrote a paper saying the three things that you're worried about are loss of control of our personal data, that it's too easy to spread misinformation, and that political advertising requires or needs transparency and understanding. I mean, my just very brief question is, do you maintain the optimism that technology can be developed to overcome these problems, or do we need to look beyond technology to manage these?
I think technology always works hand in hand with law and regulation. So very important that we use both types of our brain to look at this, both the technical and the social piece to look at it in the future. Am I optimistic? Yes, because actually when you look at history, you know, crazy to imagine the web will just remain as it is. Everybody is right now looking at the way social networks are designed. They're changing them. They're trying out experiments. So people are designing new social networks all the time. People are designing new systems which are decentralized. So, yeah, I am optimistic, but it's only going to happen because lots of people care about it very, very much. And that's not just people writing code. It's people writing laws, and it's people, random people, you know, teachers, and it's people in the street. The people listening to us have to care very carefully about this, and there might come when they have to step in and say, no, actually, this is a world I want. I don't want a world like that. I want a world like this, and I'm going to fight for it.
Tim Berners-Lee, congratulations again, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Megna.
Tim Berners-Lee is the inventor of the World Wide Web and the winner of this year's Turing Award from the Association for Computing Machinery. It's considered the Nobel Prize for Computer Science. He's also director of the Global Standards Group, the World Wide Web Consortium, founding director of the World Wide Web Foundation, co-founder of the Open Data Institute, and a professor at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. That's where we spoke with him. And by the way, of course, we have a link to Sir Tim's manifesto for a new approach to the web. It's at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.